podcast is part of the Sports Social Podcast Network.
I'm Sam Keir, host of Hitman for Hire, a year in the life of a franchise cricketer. For the past 12 months, I've been talking to T20 star David Visa, getting his take from behind the scenes at the IPL, the 100 and the rest of the world's biggest leagues.
That's the Donny Review system, Diogis. There's no ways in my mind that was up.
These guys don't know how to win at this stage.
He had his driver pick him up in his Bentley.
People start chanting your name. You kind of have to pinch yourself.
Hitman for Hire, a year in the life of a franchise cricketer. Listen now, wherever you get your podcasts.
Sport Social.
Hello, no introductory music today, just the sound of the wind and rain howling across the UK this morning, a metaphor for the storm that has completely destroyed England's Ashes hopes. Highlighted today by this sort of tornado which blew through the England batting in the name of Scott Boland, and the England batting lasting just 27 overs in total in that second innings at the MCG to record England's lowest score in Australia since the early 1900s and their ninth test match defeat in this calendar year, the worst ever. So, Simon, not a good start to a podcast, really, is it?
Well, it was a feeble effort, really, from England. I think we both knew last night. We talked about it. We knew the Ashes were gone, really. It's just a question of what the margin of victory was going to be. I have to say, when I woke up this morning, I think first thing I was thinking is, you know, what are those COVID tests like for the England players? Have they passed them all? Yes. So on we went to the MCG. I didn't actually consider England losing by an innings. I thought they would score 82 or more to make Australia bat again. I think you did as well. But the idea of them being bowled out for under 82, and you know, for 267 to be a sufficient margin in the first innings to force an innings victory. I mean, incredible, really. And then, you know, there are lots of other stats flying around. England have been bowled out four times inside 30 overs in the last 4 years. In the previous 114 years, they've been bowled out four times in under 30 overs. It was the shortest test match in Australia since 1950, 180.4 overs. I mean, there are lots of stats. The 54 ducks, which is in a calendar year, which equals the record. And those defeats in a year, ninth defeat, that actually equals a record. It's Bangladesh in 2003. They lost nine test matches. But it was a really dispiriting day for England. Obviously, a great day for Australia, and that their supporters turned out. They knew they were going to win the Ashes today, I think. And, you know, they were celebrated with Scott Boland. I mean, what an incredible day for a man who, you know, 2 days ago was probably just happy to win his first test cap. Of course, he wanted to perform well. He wanted to take a wicket or two, take a few catches, score some runs if he possibly can. But to take 6 for 7, I mean, they were just incredible figures. Have you ever had figures like that in your career? So, you know, so few runs for so wickets.
Yeah, extraordinary. Actually, I once took 9 for 18, but it was against an Oxford University college, and the last man refused to bat, and the pitch was appalling. So, I don't think it's really a fair thing, but I mean, it is extraordinary. 6 or 7. I mean, Scott Boland, looking at him after play, he was walking around the MCG in a bit of a daze, imagining it was a dream, really, because it was a dream. It was a fantasy, taking wickets like that so easily. Of course, it will never be as easy again. He probably bowled better for less reward, actually. I mean, he bowled well, but it was one of those occasions where every ball that he bowled did a little bit off the pitch, and enough of them were in the business area to take the edge or get through between bat and pad, and he got the verdicts. You know, there were a couple of, well, one very marginal LBW decision to Johnny Bairstow, sort of brushing the varnish on the top of the bales, as was the case with David Milan earlier on the day before as well. Everything went for Australia. It was one of those dream things. I mean, a bit like when Stuart Broad bowled Australia out for 60 at Trent Bridge, really. It's the same kind of thing. The ball, beautifully pitched, did enough off the pitch. In a way, you know, you don't want the ball to do too much, just enough. You know, the bat's only 4 inches wide, so the middle of the bat is, from the middle to the edge is only 2 inches. So, you know, you only want to go a little bit, sort of move it an inch or so, and you are potentially going to get the edge. And I thought something like Joe Root's dismissal was a classic example. Beautiful delivery, not quite a half volley. The shot was reasonable, really. You could say he was slightly across it, but the ball just moved enough to take the edge. Beautiful catch at first slip by David Warner. A lovely dismissal, actually, earned by the bowler and the pitch. But there's no getting away from it. From an overall perspective, it was a pitiful performance by England.
Yeah, just a couple of other stats, or one that really caught my eye. In 2021, you mentioned Joe Root there. I mean, he's been so much better than anyone else in the England side. He carried the England side this year with his batting. So 1,708 runs at 61. England played 15 test matches in 2021. Rory Burns next with 530. Of course, he was left out of this test match. So they left out their second leading run scorer in the year. And do you know what the third leading run scorer in the year was for England, or who it was, or what it was? I still think what is a bit of a clue. It was extras. It was extras with 412, third leading run scorer for England in 2021. And they have serious problems, I think, with their batting. And you know, it's not a revelatory statement, but where are the techniques to cope in the cauldron of somewhere like Australia? Where are the techniques to cope in somewhere like India on spinning pitches in India? We saw that, you know, when those pitches did spin, and they spun quite a lot actually at times in India, especially in that second test match. England were found wanting. They were rolled out there and they've been rolled out here. They haven't made 300 in this test series. I think in a situation like this, everyone is sort of scouting around for answers. And there's the blame game started, isn't it? Sack the coach, sack the captain, sack the team, sack Ashley Giles, sack Tom Harrison, sack the lot of them, disband the counties. I mean, you know, you can say all sorts of things. But I suppose what you have to try to do, I think, is be constructive. One of the things about the situation they're in at the moment is the answers are not easy. And I don't think there's a short-term fix. You look around at the counties, you know, where are the players? You looked at the Lions team that played against Australia A up in Brisbane. You look down the side, okay, some promising players, but you don't think, oh, yeah, there's him and him and him. Yeah, they could definitely make England stronger. And perhaps that's the wrong place to look, you know, with the younger players. Perhaps it might be that you go for a bit more experience to sort of shore the team up in the short term. And Australia picked Alex Carey, he's 30. Scott Boland is 32. They picked Michael Nisa, who's into his 30s as well. So, you know, experienced cricketers perhaps who know their game. I mean, said that, I'm sort of, in a way, I'm sort of about to contradict myself, because you look at England from number three down to number seven, they had Milan, Root, Stokes, Bairstow, Butler, who are all very experienced cricketers. I suppose one of the problems they have is at the top of the order, and they haven't solved that problem. They had two youngsters, two under-25 players in Hamid and Crawley, and they were vulnerable. Of course, when, you know, you're two down the whole time, aren't you? And then you're under pressure. One thing Australia did do well in this series, or one of the things they did well in the series, you look at the first test, David Warner, one of their openers, made 94. In the second test, first innings, one of their openers, David Warner, made 95. In this test match, one of their openers, Marcus Harris, made 76 runs at the top of the order. It's so important. It seems to me that's one area which England somehow need to solve. But I don't think the solution is easy. And they've been trying for years now, haven't they? Since Andrew Strauss retired, and then latterly Alistair Cook, they've been looking for an opening combination to succeed, and they've tried so many people. And it has not worked. I mean, there's a whole list of them. It's probably more people than you dismissed in first-class cricket yards, in terms of numbers.
Yeah, and I guess you can read quite a lot into how good those players that they chose are by their first-class averages. You know, if you want someone to succeed at test level, especially opening the batting, then they have to have a first-class average in the 40s at least. And the majority of those players who've been tried have first-class averages in the 30s. That just suggests, and we had the statistician Dan Weston on one time, didn't we, on this show, saying, you know, you can almost project from a person's first-class average what they're going to average in Test cricket. And there have been outliers on that one, famously people like Michael Vaughan and Marcus Truscothick, whose first-class average wasn't that high, and yet they converted into being a very successful Test batsman. But those are normally the exception that proved the rule. And the standard of first-class batting, opening batting, is not high, and they're not making big scores. They're not making big hundreds or thousands of runs. Rory Burns does, playing for Surrey, and has the advantage of batting at the Oval for half his games. It is about the pitches, I think, as much as anything, because our pitches and the way that English county cricket is organised doesn't, you know, help opening batsmen play long innings and build big scores, because they're out as, almost before they've come in many cases. And it doesn't encourage them to play the sort of game that, say, Manus Labuschagne plays, which is, you know, you see the ball just short of a length on off stump, you leave it early on with confidence because you know it's going to bounce over the stumps. And you judge what to play and what to leave, and you can be confident in that. Whereas if you play on particularly early season English pitches, you can't be confident of the bounce or the movement, and therefore you can't leave the ball. You've got to try and offer a shot to it. It might get you out, it might get you runs, but it's more of a lottery. And so I don't think that and we have said this, you know, many times, but I just think that the pitches and the structure of county championship cricket does not encourage batsmen. Generally, you know, there are exceptions, but it doesn't encourage batsmen at the top of the order to play long innings and bat for a long time. And you know, just sort of doing a parallel with New Zealand, who, you know, reached their sort of nadir in about 2010 and were bottom of the ICC test rankings. And they looked at their domestic game. And John, I've talked to John Bracewell about this, who the former New Zealand spinner who became their head coach. And he said the main thing that they did was make sure that all the pitches were good. Excellent pitches, fast pitches, good bounce, encouraging spinners later in the game, but fundamentally encouraging good batsmen. And, you know, that's where people like Kane Williamson and others emerged. You know, some other kind of good players as well who can play a long innings. They emerged at that time and were able to thrive on those good pitches. It's not an easy thing to sort in English cricket. We don't have the weather, or we haven't at the moment got the organisation to play those 4-day matches in the middle of the summer. But I think that's one thing that really is necessary.
Yeah, I mean, it looks as if there are going to be more 4-day matches in the middle of the summer next year. That's one thing. I mean, that there's going to be a bit of a change there, which will help a bit, because, you know, going into a test series, you know, at the sort of back end of the summer, then players will have had some red ball cricket. And it's definitely the case that that was lacking before the series against India, and clearly it was lacking before the series against Australia. Just on Labuschagne, actually, it's quite an interesting case study, because his first class average was not that good. It was in the low 30s. He went to Glamorgan in 2019 and had a, you know, he did play in the early part of the English summer. Worked on his game, and then took his chance. And in this match, he went into the game as the world's number one ICC ranked batter. So, there are lots of things you can throw into the mix, and, you know, clearly players have succeeded over the years playing on, you know, English pitches and making the most of English pitches. And actually, lots of Australians have come over to county cricket and done really well, high quality players. But that was probably more back in the day than it is in the modern era. And Labuschagne, in that sense, is a bit of an outlier. And also as well, Yoz, I mean, there have been, you know, and there can be sometimes, and the weather is strange. I mean, we can't predict our weather, but strangely, you know, we've had some quite nice weather in April, May, and some quite flat pitches and some quite high scores. I suppose it's that sort of consistency, isn't it? And, you know, a lot of people will say it's all about white ball cricket. And I think there has been an emphasis on white ball cricket, definitely. And there are rich, yeah, you know, there are money to be made in them. They're white ball hills, aren't there? That, and for younger players, you think, well, yeah, I'll play a few decent innings in the Blast or in the 100 or whatever, and then that'll get me a contract somewhere else, and a contract somewhere else. You can make money, and it is enticing. And so it seems to me what you need to do is to persuade or have a system somehow where younger players, A, their techniques are strong, and they're, you know, they're well coached at a young age, so they have got solid base. And B, almost to incentivize players to focus on red ball cricket. I mean, that's much easier said than done, and how you actually do it is not that straightforward. But that seems to be one area that they could look at. because inevitably there'll be some soul searching, won't there, after an Ashes series defeat like this, because people are angry and you understand it. People are frustrated. I'm sure they are back in the UK. You know, this is not good enough. It keeps on happening. Let's do something about it. Let's see if we can find a way to try and win everywhere. It's not just about winning at home. And having said that, England haven't been that good at winning at home. They've dropped quite a few matches at home last summer, and they've lost a couple of test matches to the West Indies, who are not a great side. So, you know, it's there are lots of issues, and it probably needs time, and it needs thought, careful thought, and canvassing of some, you know, some proper ideas how to try to solve the problem.
Yeah, I remember when Raul Dravid came over with the Indian A team about 3 years ago, and it was prelude to a test series. I think it was 2017, wasn't it? And I talked to him for quite a long time about his work with young Indian batsmen, and he said, you know, it's frustrating that they just want to go in and hit boundaries, and they don't value a good leave, he said. But he spent time with the selected players, and this is Indian A, so England have an equivalent team, England Lions, who do go on tour and play sort of semi-test matches or longer form games against their equivalents abroad. And he just said he worked hard individually with players in the nets, and obviously in middle practices and things as well, just trying to get their mental approach stronger and kind of getting into their head that there is something satisfying about batting all day for 130. You know, he said, I loved it. I loved batting all day and getting satisfaction from a good leave. You know, and he said, the modern player just wants to smack it miles into the terraces sort of thing. So you need you need an absolute legend like that to, you know, implement those messages about getting the satisfaction from, you know, sticking it out and really playing a long innings, and how much more fulfillment that gives you at the end of the day or at the end of the match. It might not get the adrenaline, you know, flowing through the veins because you've only made 21 in the first session or something, but your contribution to the team and also to yourself, I suppose, in a way, the kind of growing, you know, the rite of passage, in a way, kind of fills you with more feeling of satisfaction at the end and fulfillment. But it's how do you get that message over? And you probably need those kind of types, the Raul Dravids, the Alistair Cooks, the Strauses, etc. You know, you need those players to come and talk to the young players and try and, you know, ingrain that message in those selected players who you feel you can identify as having that kind of potential.
Yeah, I mean, one of the sort of coaching sort of methods used these days, or one of the sort of philosophies, is to let players work it out for themselves. I mean, I know that at test level, because if you pick to play at test level, you know, you're not going to be changing it. You shouldn't be, I suppose, you know, changing your technique in the sort of few days before a test match. But I mean, obviously, you do need to tinker. I mean, Joe Root's talked in the Virtual Cricket Club, isn't he, about just changing things the whole time because bowlers work you out. So you obviously do need to be working on your game, but it's about that movement to, yeah, it's about you working on it. And I, whether that's happening for younger players as well, you know, you work it out. Here's the framework in terms of facilities and whatever, but you try to work it out for yourself, get players to think for themselves. So there's that element to it. And you can see the benefit of that in a way, you know, if a player is self-sufficient, can think about, yeah, I need to work on this aspect of my game and go away and do it for yourself. And in a way, if you can convince them of that, that's quite effective. But you also need, in a way, someone to tell you what the basics are and what you need to do to be able to succeed. So, it seems to me about trying to get that balance right. I mean, one thing we have ignored a little bit in this podcast, Yoz, is the fact that this is a pretty good Australian side in their own conditions, definitely. I mean, they're not a bad side, and they have got good bowlers. And I'm telling you, that spell last night with Stark and Cummins and the crowd roaring, you know, was phenomenal test cricket. It was gladiatorial test match cricket, and it was tough, you know, for those two young England openers, hard to survive, really tough. Stark, quality bowler. Cummins, absolute quality bowler, bowling at high pace, accurate, crowd behind them. And you're battling for your team in the Ashes, so you know this is not a bad Australian side, but you know it has been a series in which Cummins wasn't available for the second test, and Hazelwood is a top-class bowler, as we all know, wasn't available for the second and third test. And if you'd said that to England at the start of the series, or England supporters, they'd have thought, oh, hold on a second, this gives us a chance. And what do you know, Jai Richardson comes in and takes 5 wickets in the second test, and Scott Boland comes in and takes 6 in the first. It's been hard. It's hard. But I mean,
yeah, it is hard. I mean, you know, the thing is, of course, these bowlers are bowling with a huge amount of skill, certainly in the case of Cummins and Stark, and experience, but also confidence. Confidence in the fact that they've performed well in this series already, but also, more so, confidence in the fact that they know England aren't very good. And, you know, so you immediately feel buoyant when you run into bowl because you're expecting wickets. You know that Rory Burns' technique's a bit dodgy and Hamid looks a bit frail, and you know, then there's a number three coming in who's an okay player, but you know, he could easily get out as well. So you're bowling with a lot of expectation, which just makes you bowl better. No, I totally concede, though, that spell from Cummins in particular on the second evening was as hard as it's ever going to get in Test cricket. You know, the ball was nipping, every ball was doing something, a fantastic pace and line and length. You had to play virtually every ball. He wasn't even, I was watching him, because sometimes he sort of thunders to the wicket, you know, really kind of pummeling the ground and charging in. He was gliding to the wicket. He was just easing into his run-up and bowling probably a little bit within himself. And you know, sometimes when that happens, the bowling is even better and even faster, actually. The harder you try often with quick bowling, the worse it is. And he just had that beautiful rhythm, and every ball, you know, sliding onto the pitch and kissing the surface and whipping off it and nipping around either one way or the other. It was just outstanding, extraordinary. Didn't get a wicket, but he got the wickets for the others at the other end. You know, Scott Boland has to him to thank in a way, because it was so hard facing Cummins that something had to give at the other end.
So just on some of the, you know, the more nuts and bolts of England's immediate future, and it, you know, we in a way we need to keep our powder dry a bit, because what are we going to talk about for the last two test matches? Because it could be a procession here. But a lot of people saying, and I started off at the start of this podcast talking about this, you know, people saying, oh, we need a new captain, we need a new coach, we need a new managing director of cricket. Where does Joe Root stand, do you think? I listened to his post-match press conference interviews, well, his presentation interview, and an interview with Jonathan Agnew on TMS, and I saw his sort of face on camera, and you know, there was the anger after the last test match, there was that sense of sort of deflation and sadness after today. I mean, it does take it out of you, doesn't it, as being England captain. He equaled the record number of appearances as England captain in this test match. Is it inevitable, do you think, that he will go at the end of this series? Two more games, he sort of brushed off questions about his future. That's sort of inevitable, because he's sort of in the middle of a tour and there's still two games to go. Do you think it's inevitable that he will stand down after this series?
Yeah, I do. I think that there was an air of resignation about him in this test match, and towards the end anyway. And I just think that he will just feel he's gone as far as he can go in this job, and he needs to give someone else a chance. And it's not because he's been a terrible captain at all. He's a fine man, obviously had an amazing season with the bat. He's not the most brilliant tactician, but he's not a terrible captain. And most of these defeats are not his fault. But he must have to accept that he hasn't been able to get the best out of these players for whatever reason. And he's tried his absolute best. He's given everything to the job. And, you know, there's only so much a human can take. And, you know, he's played 3 series in Australia now, lost all of them, obviously only 2 as captain. I think you just have to, in the end, it wears you down and you need to refresh and give someone else a chance.
Yeah, he actually said at the start of the series, yeah, this series will define my captaincy. Well, England have lost 3-0. They've been thumped. They've been absolutely thumped in 3 test matches out here. So if Root does go, who's next in line? People are saying, no, it can't be Ben Stokes, but he's the vice-captain. So, you know, you would assume that is where it's going to go next. I heard people saying, you know, potentially Rory Burns, but he does captain at Surrey. But is he certain of his place in the side? Well, he was left out here. He's in his early 30s. That doesn't necessarily legislate against him, because we were talking earlier about the, perhaps the importance of experience. But, you know, he is England's second leading run scorer this year, albeit not with a huge number of runs, 513 in 14 matches for him, because he was left out of this game. But England have done it before, where they've given the captaincy to their sort of star all-rounders. You think of Ian Botham and Andrew Flintoff, and it hasn't really worked. So what do they do? Is it Stokes because there's no one else, or do they try and create something different or find someone different?
I think you can overthink it, actually. And, you know, I think you said this before we came into the show today, that, you know, Stokes is the obvious choice. And as vice-captain, it would seem odd, in a way, to suddenly promote somebody else ahead of him. And actually, if you compare Stokes to Botham and Flintoff, I think he's more of a thinking cricketer than either of them. You know, they were both natural, you know, fabulous, attacking, warrior-like cricketers. And whereas Stokes is that, but he's also a thinking cricketer who, you know, does read the game well and studies the game and thinks about the game very deeply. And so I think he would be good. I mean, obviously, part of captaincy is man management. And that is maybe where Root has failed a bit. And I don't know what Stokes would be like as a man manager, but everybody respects him. He obviously does speak in team meetings quite a lot, and people say, I'll give you an example. And in that run up to the World Cup final in 2019, there was a crisis moment when England were about to play India, and they had to win. They'd lost against Sri Lanka and Australia, and if they didn't win their last couple of games, they were out. So it became a crunch match, that India game at Edgbaston, June the 30th, I think it was. And they had a total heart-to-heart. They brought in their sports psychologist for a session with all of them, a guy called David Young. And he encouraged all the players to voice their fears and worries about the situation. And Stokes was the most powerful voice in that meeting, saying, yes, I'm actually nervous, I'm worried, I'm fearful that we're going to get knocked out here. We're going to play poorly, and we're going out of the World Cup, which everyone has tipped us to win. And he was very emotional in his speech. And apparently it created, and I've talked to other players about this, all the players were really moved and affected and invigorated by his speech, that even a person as strong and obviously sort of robust as Stokes was admitting to fear of failure. And I think that actually emboldened the team to then go and play their natural game. They obviously demolished India and went on to win the World Cup. So, you know, you can see Stokes is an honest man who can speak his mind and has the massive respect of the team. So I think, you know, he is the obvious choice to captain. And there's an example of one little bit of this Ashes series when he did captain, when Root was off the field for, what, half an hour or something. And that was one of England's best spells, when the bowlers pitched the ball up, kept going past the bat. He sort of ordered them, I think, or implored them to pitch the ball a bit fuller. They did. And they, you know, there was a better spell of play for England when Stokes was in charge. So all the roads point to that being the logical decision.
What about Chris Silverwood's position as head coach?
I think he's taken on too much. I think, you know, being lumbered with coaching, being effectively the head coach in all three formats and being the chief selector, is just too much for one person. And I think, you know, especially Test cricket is so sophisticated now, and you need someone with a lot of experience. You know, so the people like Andy Flower and Trevor Bayliss and, you know, Duncan Fletcher, really steeped in cricket all round the world, and in Cup One case anyway, Flower, you know, a fantastic player as well. That does help. If they've got that integrity, that depth of knowledge, that range of understanding, which I think you need in Test cricket. In One Day cricket, white ball cricket, you know, a Silverwood is probably fine, because, you know, there's a lot of data, there's a lot of strategies and techniques and things which you can sort of, it's kind of simpler in a way, I think. And you can, you know, rely on stats a bit more. But with the mental approach required for Test cricket and the intricacies of technique and so on, you need real major figures. And, you know, Justin Langer is a great example. You know, what an incredible player he was. What a deep thinking man he is. And I'm not saying that Chris Silverwood is not a deep thinking man, but I think you want someone of that stature to be your test match coach to get the best out of the players, or help to get the best out of the players. So I would be inclined to think of Silverwood more as a white ball coach and find somebody else to be the test match coach.
Well, Ashley Shearer is often are the sort of nemesis of coaches. Duncan Fletcher left not long after an Ashes series defeat in Australia. It was actually after the World Cup. The World Cup came straight after the Ashes. Andy Flower, he was done for after an Ashes series. Trevor Bayliss stood down after the last Ashes series. Chris Silverwood's only been in the job for 2 years. But, you know, the criticism is circling around him, and it's inevitable that that happens, especially, I think, you know, especially because he's taken on that role as well. I want to be the main man. So, and, you know, when you do that, then you are inevitably more vulnerable. But it may be with Chris Silverwood that people are looking in the wrong place, that, you know, the problems are far more fundamental. The idea, you know, can Chris Silverwood turn round a sort of system in a way that's against him, and a build-up as well that was against him. They did all this planning, but in the end, when it came to it, they had no cricket before the first test at the Gabba. What about, not so much for this series, because you've got your 18, haven't you? Your 17 or whatever it is in your tour party. What about in terms of England got three test match series in the West Indies? I know they've got the Ashes series to sort out. I mean, do you see a much different team in the West Indies, or is it a case of trying to make the most of the players? They have Joe Root saying today, these are the best players in the county system. You know, so do they actually say, well, there are probably players of a similar level out there, you know, are they that much better than anyone else, or is it actually there's sort of like a flat line of talent, and you could almost choose, you know, you could almost choose 11 from, I don't know, 40 or 11 from 35, and you'd almost get the something similar, or can you just find something that's a bit better, you know, that extra 2-5% if you do tinker a bit or overhaul the side a bit, or how do you see the side going forward?
I think chopping and changing is bad, because you never sort of move forward. You're and pitching people in, and, you know, the gap between domestic cricket and test cricket is quite large. So you just never know when you pick someone whether they are going to make that leap or not. And for me, and I have said this several times, I know, but for me, Zach Crawley has the makings of being a very good test player. He has presence. He has a technique. He is able to, you know, score quickly and as well as stay in. And having proved himself, was playing a long innings against Pakistan.
He hasn't been staying in much this year, Yoz.
No, he hasn't. But I mean, he hasn't had much cricket. That's the trouble. I mean, I know that before he was dropped from the test team the first time, he had a poorish run, and that can happen. But I just feel he's got something in his game. And I also think that about Ollie Pope as well, who certainly at county level has made big scores and shown adaptability. He does look a bit, you know, frenetic against spin at the moment, but I think he's got the makings of being a fine test player as well. So I would be sticking with those two and finding some others to fit around. You know, people are saying what to do with Jos Buttler. It's impossible to know. And, you know, with Jos Buttler, he's someone who I feel he bats best when he knows what's expected. And when I say what's expected, he knows what the target is. So his best innings for England in the last two years in test cricket was that run chase against Pakistan at Old Trafford, when he and Chris Wokes were sort of the last pair of recognised batsmen chasing whatever score it was. And they put on how many? Remind me. 140 or something?
They needed about 270 to win. They came together at around about 100 for five, and they took England fairly close to their winning target.
Yeah, and so he knew, and he said, you know, I batted then as if it was a one-day game, and I knew, you know, when to raise the tempo. And I feel he bats best in England colours, and I say that, you know, whether it's whites or coloured clothing, when he knows what the target is. So either opening the batting in white ball cricket, knowing you've got to get the team off to a fast start, and, you know, taking risks and so on is part of his game, but they're calculated risks, or chasing runs in a white ball game, you know what the target is, or chasing runs in a test match, and you know what the target is. When it's open-ended and he goes into bat in a test match at 180 for five or 100 and 210 for four or whatever, I just don't feel he's quite got the, he hasn't quite worked it out in his head how to play. And that's the problem that England have with him at the moment. You know, I hope he gets there, but maybe the will isn't there. You know, maybe he just wants to play the white ball game, and perhaps the test match red ball game has become too hard for him.
Mm. It's not impossible to see Jos Buttler just focusing on white ball cricket in the future and say, well, you know, this tour and no further. It could well happen. And, you know, as I said, there's often a lot of fallout from an Ashes series. We've talked over this, Jos, for half an hour or so. Lots of people out there will have their own ideas and about what changes should happen around the England team and in the game itself. A lot of people saying, yeah, there needs to be a lot more focus on red ball cricket as opposed to white ball cricket. And of course, there was after the 2015 World Cup when England had such a wretched time in Australia. Afterwards, you know, they said, thus far, no further, we need to change. And I wonder whether this tour will be a sort of watershed moment. But I think one of the things we've sort of concluded from our conversations and thinking about it and talking about it, sort of off-air, if you like, before this podcast, no easy answers. England have lots of problems, and they could well be in for a thin time of it. They've had a very thin time of it in the last year. They could be in for some more thin times in the future. Mm. No easy answers.
I agree. But you know, the answers are necessary, because although I said in a previous show, it's not as important winning away as it is winning at home. And you know, this is going on in the middle of the night. I mean, you know, this all unfolded last night before anyone had woken up again, unless they stayed up to watch it, obviously. So there's a sort of element of invisibility about it, though obviously there'll be the headlines today, which draws everyone's attention to it. It's more important to win at home, but there is now the World Test Championship. So every test match counts, whether it's at home or away. And England at the moment will be sliding down that World Test Championship table, you know, an inexorable slide down it at the moment. One little galling stat here that someone's posted on Twitter: Australia retains the urn inside 12 days. England spent longer quarantining on the Gold Coast.
Yeah, that just about sums it up, doesn't it? I mean, there are so many stats, fact, whatever, knocking around today that are all fairly depressing for England supporters. But yeah, what you hope is that this is a sort of a moment where people do take stock and think, right, this is, yeah, things have to change. It's not good enough to just keep coming to Australia, going to India and losing. You have, and also the other point is, I make it again, it's England have started losing at home as well. So it's all very well to say it's invisible here, and to some extent it is, although I think people do actually invest quite a lot of stock in the Ashes. People want England to do well here, and they do follow the series, and there's a sense of deflation when it goes wrong here. But if England start to lose at home, it will have a knock-on effect. People become disgruntled. And when that happened in the 90s, there were efforts to change it, and we had things like four-day cricket started, for example, and was embedded, proper four-day cricket. Central contracts. So in a way, and that helped, I think, for central contracts did help. So there needs to be a deep think, and there needs to be some sort of reset, but not with, people, I think, were suggesting things then, but they're not so obvious now. So, it is that thing. There needs to be a sort of trawl of ideas and a synthesis, actually, and to try to find the best ones and some best policies to try to improve England's red ball team.
I mean, if you look at what happened with the white ball game after the 2015 disastrous World Cup, there were changes. Obviously, Andrew Strauss was brought in as director of cricket. Paul Downton was sacked as director of cricket, and Andrew Strauss was brought in. And the first two things he did was appoint Owen Morgan as captain and totally placed his faith in Morgan, and then appointed Trevor Bayliss as coach. They identified someone who had a very good track record in white ball cricket, and also someone who wanted to put all the emphasis and responsibility and authority in the captain as well, rather than a coach who was too intrusive. And that combination, that obviously worked beautifully. And they also identified a number of players they were going to stick with over that period that they saw as the solution to England's white ball cricket. And obviously that ended with the World Cup win.
Yeah, I mean, that's true. And I think that, but there's one fundamental difference that I see is that England did have that white ball talent, and they needed to harness it and they needed to release it. Whereas I don't, when I look around, I don't see as much red ball talent. And I think that is one of the fundamental problems, that somehow or other in the next year or two or three or four, whatever, England need to put an emphasis on nurturing red ball talent. How they do that, it's not, as we've suggested in this podcast, they're not easy answers. Mm.
Well, I mean, I'm sorry to that it's all so gloomy. Cheer yourself up by looking at our Ashes Heroes NFT collection. NFT are those non-fungible tokens, which I know is the buzzword for next year, the NFT. And you can own an Ashes Heroes NFT. And there are so many really interesting characters down the years that have played in Ashes Test from both teams. You'll have forgotten many of them. You can rekindle your memory with some of them if you go to our ashesheroes.com website and have a look at those great heroes, which we've ranked from 100 to 1. Not many of this current England team are in that rankings, but one or two are, obviously Joe Root being one. So have a look at that, actually, because it might just, I don't know, cheer you up or make you deflect your mind from this calamity that's unfolded in Australia.
On to Sydney we go. Well, fingers crossed anyway, depending on the COVID situation. Still two more tests to go. Sydney and Hobart, and England's goal, Joe Root said it in his post-match interview, not to lose 5-0. It's happened before. England desperate to avoid it happening again. But the incentive for Australia, World Test Championship points. They don't want to be watching New Zealand or India or whatever compete in the final this time. They want to be in that final. So we'll be back for the Sydney Test match. Is it going to get any better? Well, I can't promise you that, but we'll be back with a review of the first day of the Sydney Test match in the new year. So all that remains for me and you, Yoz, to before then, is to wish our listeners a very happy new year.
Yes, happy new year to all of you, and thanks very much for listening. Let's look forward to 2022.
Sports Social Podcast Network.